My guest this week runs a consultancy firm called Enlightenment Economics and is vice chair of the BBC Trust. Diane Coyle has a doctorate in economics from Harvard and is author of The Economics of Enough, How to Run the Economy as If the Future Matters. Diane Coyle, you're welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be talking to you.
That last suggests that you're concerned that Western countries are showing signs of a willingness to mortgage the future to get out of current difficulties. You're concerned about that.
Yes, because this struck me first during the financial crisis, when a financial system that we had turned out to be literally unsustainable in that it collapsed. And I was watching the London Interbank Offer Rate in the Financial Times, which I read assiduously every morning, and it was creeping higher and higher. This is the rate at which banks lend each other money overnight. As we know now, it was rigged anyway and should have been even higher. But I looked at it and I thought, the banks don't trust each other with their money. So I don't really trust them with my money either. And I took out lots of cash.
What year was that?
This is 2008.
After, 2008,
after
right,
the
okay.
Lehman Brothers. Yeah. We know now that the payments mechanisms, the ATMs, the way you pay in the supermarket with your debit card, the way companies pay each other, that almost ground to a halt. It was a literally unsustainable system. So I started from the financial sector, looking at how we had come to build such an important structure in the economy that could not last. And it occurred to me that this was a theme across a number of social problems. When you talk about sustainability, usually people talk about the environment and the extent to which we've borrowed assets and have spent our future ability to live a good life in leading a consumerist existence today. That's what people normally mean by it. But I think socially as well, when you look at the way inequality has grown in many of the Western countries, and the social tensions that gives rise to the chasm between different groups of people in society, the rich and the poor, who literally never meet each other. They don't go into the same spaces, the same public spaces. And how can that be sustainable? Isn't there something about our future that we've compromised there as well?
But if you look at a broad map of the post-war world, where you had, say, until the 1980s or thereabouts, you had an agreed form of social welfare capitalism. It seemed okay for governments to intervene. Then came deregulation and privatization. Did something happen, at that time in the 80s,
yes,
that changed the whole world, if you like?
I think at least two things happened to coincide then. One was that the new technologies, the information and communication technologies, really started to be implemented widely across the economy and society. And that was a time when a lot of businesses were delayering, changing the old hierarchies, setting up network structures, operating across global boundaries, and we got globalization. And that generated some trends like there being people who could command much higher incomes than they used to, and people creating startups that floated on the stock market that created a lot of money. So there was that technology-driven trend in the economy. And the politics played into that, the end of the Cold War and the collapse of communism and Thatcher and Reagan. And a deliberate decision by politicians, voted in democratically, to reinforce those trends, to undermine the power of unions and organised labour and to reduce taxes for the very well-off.
But isn't it the case that technology was an intensifier more than anything else? In other words, the basic reality was the fact that you had less, there seemed to be less role for government.
I think the technology is quite fundamental, actually, that social structures are, it sounds very Marxist, doesn't it? Social structures are built on a foundation of certain technologies. And the way the economy is organised will change when technologies change so radically. It's what an economist would call a general purpose technology.
Yeah, so in other words, technology used in that very basic sense as shaping the way production occurs and so on. In that sense, it can be
exactly
determinative, and that's the sense of what you have in mind.
Exactly. So, for example, when it's very expensive to convey information, a hierarchy is actually an efficient structure. You economise on the amount of information you have to exchange between people. When it's very cheap and easy to pass information around, then the most economically efficient structure is a much flatter one where people can take decisions for themselves and don't need to pass it up the hierarchy all the time.
How did the people who lost have their persuade us all to have their losses socialised? How did they do that?
That's a really good question. And I think it's that they made use of complexity. And I'm not even sure how many people in the banking industry themselves understand exactly how much the system is rigged in their favour. And it's because of the way wealth actually turns into political power, and that the influence of bankers and their lobbyists on regulation slowly and steadily over time reinforced their own ability to make money. So the tax structures that make it cheap to raise debt but not to raise equity means that we've got very leveraged banks. The way that incomes are taxed meant that it was they were able to pay themselves bonuses in particular structures.
But surely that in order to persuade the taxpayer to subvent them, they have to have some kind of argument of the form that if we go under, then the whole thing collapses. What kind of arguments might they muster at that point?
Well, there's a fundamental truth in the fact that if the financial system goes under, the economy goes under. It would have been absolutely catastrophic if the banks had not been bailed out in 2008. So there's a fundamental truth in that. They would also point to the contribution of the financial sector to GDP over the 1980s. But it turns out that the definition of the financial sector's contribution to GDP was changed in a way that made it appear much bigger than you might argue it is. You know, we think of GDP as a kind of natural entity to be discovered and measured, but it's an intellectual construct, actually, and the definition was changed to exaggerate the contribution of finance. But they would have pointed and believed in their contribution to the economy and the fact that the financial sector does employ lots of people.
And presumably in the American system, in the American side of the equation, people got more money back.
Well, some people did.
Yeah. So they did better on the whole than was the case in this part of the world and in Europe. Would that be true?
Well, some people did. America is actually unique in how little people outside the top 10% of the income distribution shared in the gains in GDP since the 1980s.
Yes, isn't that... So how do you evaluate that? I mean, what grounded that inequality and the rise of it, the intensification of it?
I think because it differs between countries so much, you have to look to political decisions to explain that. And I think in America there was a much more sustained attack on collective bargaining and a much more change in the tax system, much more heavily geared towards tax cuts for the well-off and not taxing the kind of income that the very well-off would earn.
But what underpinned that? I mean, one of the extraordinary anomalies of American politics is that, in fact, people seem to vote against their own economic interests. I mean, the large majority of people.
Mm. Well, I think one reason is the American dream and the belief, however wrong it is, that people actually have the opportunity to do that for themselves. So there's a belief in equality of opportunity, even if it's not actually realised in practice. And I think also you have to look to political arguments about the culture wars and the chasm that grew between the left-wing fringe of the Democrats and their emphasis on identity politics and middle America.
You make the point that in 2008 the left-wing moment didn't happen. Many expected it would. Were you surprised that it didn't happen?
Disappointed, I think. Disappointed that not just left-wing politicians, but Democratic politicians generally, have continued to bow to the power of the financial lobbies. In the UK, the banking sector has become more and more concentrated. The power of the high street banks is extremely large, and they can keep out competition. I find it very hard to understand why no politicians have taken some quite decisive action to even have a competition inquiry looking at the power of those.
But what is it? Is it what they're contributing by way of funds to politicians? What gives them their ultimate power?
I think politicians do seem to believe that if they do anything to disrupt the banking system, it will have such harmful consequences for the economy that they can't take the risk.
Isn't it amazing, that whole shift from, and we know Keynes was never that strong on the productive component. I mean, he seemed to emphasise demand, but the way the world of capitalism itself has played down the productive component. I mean, we lived in an era of what is rightly called financial capitalism, isn't that so?
Yes, and I don't think we have a very clear picture about the productive capacity of the Western economies, the trade flows between West and East. The statistics that we have are actually pretty inadequate to capture where the value is really being added and where the wealth is really being created.
I mean, the first inkling I got of this was when I read that some Japanese company could make more money through their investments than they could through production. That gives us an insight into it, doesn't it, in however small a way?
Lots of companies are actually pension funds now with small productive arms attached to them. There are lots of manufacturing companies that, as we know, don't manufacture anything. Everything is outsourced apart from the design and central intelligence of the products. I think we've all been surprised looking at the food chain and discovering how little of the food that we eat is made where we think it's made.
Yeah. And of course what feeds into that is your old pile technology, because in an increasingly automated world there's less and less for the individual worker to do.
I've looked at the textile sector, the clothing sector, and China's role in that. And it's quite interesting because we have this impression that China is the cheap labour economy. And when globalisation started, that was certainly the case. But it's very quickly become itself an outsourcer, and a lot of the production now is outsourced to even cheaper countries like Cambodia or Vietnam. And China has become a logistical specialist. So what they mainly do is take orders and match it with supplies and ship it to the shops in the right kind of packaging at exactly the right kind of time. So even they are not a manufacturing powerhouse in the way that we imagine.
Wow, how interesting.
At least in that one sector.
Yeah. Central to your thinking, it seems to me, is the need for markets to reflect values. I mean, you make this point again and again, that you say if desired social values are reflected in actual market institutions, then markets remain a most effective mechanism. The problem is, isn't it, is getting agreement on those values.
Yes. And there's been a very interesting debate about this since Michael Sandel published his book about what it is that markets value. And I think some of the examples that he gives really highlight how difficult it is to pin it down. He gives the example of queuing for free tickets for the plays in Central Park in New York. And some people pay other people to stand in line to get the free tickets for them, and he thinks this is morally reprehensible. Actually, you're paying people for their time. And we pay people for their time in pretty much any service activity. So if I want to go out to the cinema and hire a babysitter, I'm paying somebody for their time. And so we have some kind of moral intuition, or some people do, that one of them is good and one of them is not. But I think we need to interrogate that much more closely than we have. But the mistake is to think that markets are an abstraction, they're social institutions.
Which may or may not be infused with certain values.
Yes. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you look at from Keynes on right through to Stiglitz, the great critics of the system. They are critics of the system. I mean, they wouldn't get rid of it.
That's right.
Nor would you.
And there are all kinds of circumstances in which markets do work very well to improve people's welfare. They're in any kind of straightforward, immediate transaction where you don't need to think about an uncertain future, markets work terribly well. And in fact, they work so well that even pigeons bidding for food will operate as if they were operating in a free market. Mm. And then others where they don't. And we don't have a good idea about where they work well and where they don't. But they're a process. There's a money-free market for kidney transplants in the United States devised by last year's Nobel Prize winner, Al Roth. It's a market mechanism. It doesn't involve money. It increases welfare enormously. The number of people who have survived since he introduced his market for donors has been quite staggering. So this is an area where I think economists need to do much more careful research and thinking, and working with philosophers and psychologists about it too.
But it's intriguing all the time, isn't it, as to what's driving the dysfunction. I mean, it seems to me from what you say that in a way the rise of the financial sector seems one part of it, and that you know, you're saying the reforms. You make the point that the reforms done post Lehman have been minimal. I mean, they haven't. So what's going on there that they haven't cleaned up their act, the bankers?
Maybe I'm just too impatient. Maybe it takes time. And in the current bonus round, we are seeing signs that the bankers are acknowledging the validity of the criticism that they've received. So maybe it takes time and that will improve. There is a collective action problem, though. I was talking to a very senior banker who said that he absolutely agreed with me that bankers were paid far, far too much money and it needed to be decreased by several zeros.
May I ask what nationality he was?
He was a British banker, a very senior British banker. And he said, but the problem is that if we stop doing that ourselves, our bankers, our good people, will just get poached away by another institution. We can't stop it by ourselves. But it's an area where governments are still quite reluctant to intervene. I think the way we have of thinking about the role of government is still very much determined by that 80s onwards market-type philosophy. And so government doesn't think it's proper to intervene so directly in a market that you say, British banking industry, I'm terribly sorry, but you can no longer pay multi-million pound bonuses.
Do you still have we devoted enough attention to that great moment of transition between the collapse of the Keynesian consensus in the late 70s, early 80s, and the rise of the new kind of order? Have we paid enough attention to the transition itself?
Perhaps not. There is a very interesting book about called Masters of the Universe, about the evolution of that Hayekian neoliberal intellectual order, which made it plain to me that actually it was a decades-long political project which took organisation. I think quite often we think the ideas, talking about the ideas, is enough to change the climate. And actually there's a lot of everyday common and garden politics and organisation that goes.
We're back all the time, aren't we, into what's intuitively, that is, at that level, as to what's driving it. Is it economics, politics, or culture? And for the moment, I would be happy to subsume technology under economics for the purpose of that analysis. I mean,
but it's all of them, isn't it?
They operate together. Sure, but I'm saying that sometimes people tend to have a favourite in terms of what they think is ultimately driving. But as you say, it's a mixture, and at different times, presumably, one is more powerful than another.
So I think the lesson I draw is that it's very hard to change the trajectory of a society or an economy. And a lot of people need to organise a lot of things across all of those waterfronts that you mentioned.
You quote Daniel Bell, who spoke about the necessary trade-off between efficiency, fairness and freedom, that great Triun set of factors. Do you agree with Bell that at most we can accommodate two out of three? That is to say, we can't have efficiency, fairness and freedom. We have to choose two of those.
I certainly agree that we need to triangulate between them, and that in any period when you've had an emphasis too much on one leg or the other, you're going to have to steer things back in the other way.
I mean, forgive me, at the moment fairness is the one taking a hammering, isn't it?
It has been, and I think that's changing, and I think we are definitely seeing a reaction to that. And maybe in a generation's time, that will turn out to have gone too far the other way. So I think it's a mistake to think you can have any kind of stasis, and you're always trying to navigate between forces that are going to be inevitably in tension with each other and to negotiate the trade-offs.
It seems to me that even the most virulent forms of aggressive capitalism, still, even those systems still hold out some notion of a safety net. I mean, they're not totally brutal. I do think that's true. They would even let go. There are parts of the world systems would let go of the safety net itself.
I think the safety net is obviously something that comes with the increasing wealth of a country. So very poor countries don't have them. I'm not sure that I'd want to rely on the safety net if I lived in the United States. It seems to me to be an extremely unequal country with inequalities that are not often spoken about in public discourse. The proportion of young black men who go to prison in the United States and never, ever have a job, ever, in their lifetimes is, I can't remember the figure, but it is extraordinary. So certainly in Europe we still, I think, truly believe in the notion of a safety net. I'm not sure how much the Americans actually do.
That's interesting. So maybe it's the rhetoric. There's still rhetoric there, I suppose, and perhaps it's no more than that, that you occasionally hear in the United States that even the toughest of them seem to invoke some notion of a safety net. You have your doubts about that.
I think I do, and I think we overestimate the similarities between the US and Europe because of, well, in the English-speaking world, because of the common language. Yeah. And we look to America for political ideas and trends, and actually it's rather different from Europe.
It seems, doesn't it, that the ultimate justification for the system itself, the system that are you saying we're stuck with, is the fact that the spontaneity and the lack of planning in it helps production, is consonant with being more productive.
Yes. I mean, the key thing about markets and capitalism is that they enable innovation. They enable people to have new ideas and do things in different ways, a kind of process of discovery of new things and what might work. And any kind of planning will never capture anything new. The essence of growth isn't more stuff. It isn't more cars and bigger houses and more expensive handbags. It's new things. It's innovations. Hmm. And even trivial ones contribute greatly to economic welfare. So anything from genetic technology and new medicines and the way that might contribute to human health to, oh, I don't know, nanoparticles in your clothing that will make them last longer. So all of these things are what's enabled by markets and capitalism, by the state as well, because investment in that kind of R&D and infrastructure is important. You can't have just one or just the other. You need them both.
For you, as I read your book, it's very much a binary universe in the sense that, you know, you're saying we need both markets and the state. But what about the growing power of the large corporations? I mean, you know, often they're now interchangeable with states, they've higher GDPs and so on.
I think people overestimate the power of corporations.
Interesting.
In a sense.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're very big. They lobby. On the other hand, if a government decides to pass a law within its territory, it will always trump corporations. It might chase them away, it might chase them offshore. But
you say pass a law, I mean, they still have the power, surely the power in terms of donorship of various kinds, you know. Perhaps one doesn't want to get run away with this idea, but I sense that corporations are more powerful than you're willing to acknowledge.
Well, I'm not denying that they have some power.
Mm.
And obviously they have access to politicians and they shape
yes.
what politicians know about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if a big corporation says, if you do this, it will be terrible because we move our production from this plant and it'll be very bad for the economy, then a politician might well believe it and back away from a change. But equally, the amount of tax that a company pays in a given territory is determined by the government of that territory and the tax authorities and how they enforce it. So the fuss that we've seen here in this country about some big corporations not paying enough tax, a good deal of the blame for that, I think, must lie with the tax authorities and the kinds of discussions that they have. So there's a sort of political courage, I guess, that's needed. But the actual power to pass laws still lies with national governments. So that's the sense in which I think the power of companies is overstated.
Where are we 5 years after 2008? Where are we now?
I veer between being quite optimistic and quite pessimistic. I think there's still an opportunity in the widespread dissatisfaction with the system, with the way it's been operating, for some political change. I think there are fantastically encouraging signs of social entrepreneurship and innovation using new technologies, and all very small scale at the moment, but I think it's fantastically encouraging that people are discovering that they can take certain forms of social action and collective action, and they're empowered to do that. And then on the other hand, I look at the banking system and I think it's still pretty fragile, and I'm not sure that we're out of the woods in terms of the euro crisis. And there's been very little reform to the banking system and very little courage about addressing income inequality. So I don't know where we are.
Some years ago we spoke of Japan and Germany having different kinds of capitalism to the rest of the world, more social welfare oriented than the more cutthroat variety you found in America and elsewhere. I'm wondering if you can think of the world today in terms of a map. For example, just take Europe and the UK. Do you think they're more in common in terms of sharing a safety net that, say, that's something they don't share with America?
I think there are a lot of commonalities, cultural and social, between the UK and the EU. So even though on the face of it, the UK looks like an extraordinarily different country, it's less different than we think. And actually, there are big differences between London and the rest of the UK as well.
Do you think that the desire to have London as a major financial capital, has that skewed the kind of capitalism you have here?
It has, certainly.
Yeah.
It has skewed it.
Sure.
And it's been an unhealthy imbalance in the economy that I hope will reverse.
Its main advantages being what?
The advantages?
The advantages are
for London, which is a fantastic city and a great generator of wealth, and the excitement, the cultural riches, which in turn create the innovations and ideas. It's all been terrific for London, but it has distorted the rest of the British economy. But there are, in a way, every form of capitalism is unique, and every country will bring to it its own history and its own culture. And I think the one commonality, and it does also mark Europe out from the United States, is demographic, actually. And one of the big issues that needs to be discussed in political life is the contract between the generations. And Germany, Spain, Italy have pretty terrible demographics. Their populations are aging very rapidly and shrinking. They haven't adjusted their pension systems very much. At some point, there will be a real reckoning about the fiscal burden and the way that dependents are supported in all the European countries, actually.
Joanne Coyle, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.